Thank you. Be seated.
Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Bridgestone Firestone versus Lynn Jones.
May it please the court, Mr. Jones will present argument to petitioner. Petitioner has observed 5 minutes
of rebuttal. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case represents the next step in this court's continuing refinement of its interpretation of the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution. Since at least 1955, the court has held that the open court provision applies only to those common law causes of action which are well-established, well-defined, or in the words of the Marino case, well-recognized. This case now gives the court an opportunity to decide what those phrases mean, or at any rate, to decide what those phrases do not mean. The background of the case is quite simple. In 1985, the legislature passed a statute which states, use or non-use of a safety belt is not admissible evidence in a civil trial. Now, the parties agree that in a case involving a claim of a defective safety belt, application of this statute would have the effect of abolishing the plaintiff's cause of action. The trial court held that the statute did have that effect, and the Court of Appeals agreed but held the statute unconstitutional under the open courts provision.
Before we get to your constitutional issue, we first have to decide what the legislature meant.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Indeed, that the intent of this statute, either the plan, by whatever route we get there, we have to decide the statute would apply to this kind of a claim.
Absolutely.
And I wish you would address that first.
I'll be happy to. Both lower courts held that the statute would have that effect, and they reached that conclusion on several bases. The first is the plain meaning of the statute, and of course, under this court's precedent, that is the beginning of the inquiry, and if the statute is of plain meaning, that is the end of the inquiry as well. And the statute, we submit, could not have been clearer in its categorical prohibition of the use of safety belt evidence in any civil trial. When you compare and contrast the statute in Texas to the similar statutes in many other states, you find that only three other states have a seatbelt evidentiary preclusion statute of the sweeping breadth of the Texas statute. Most of the statutes specifically apply only to non-use. Many of the statutes specifically apply only to use of the evidence for the purpose of showing failure to mitigate damages or contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiffs. Particularly instructive are the statutes of a couple of states, which in one case create a crashworthiness exception to the evidentiary preclusion, and in another case create an exception for defective seatbelt claims. The Texas legislature could have chosen either of those options, or the options of limiting preclusion to non-use, or the option of limiting preclusion to use for mitigation or contributory negligence, but it chose none of those options and instead enacted a statute The three other states, Your Honor, and this is in our brief in the Court of Appeals, although not in this court, are Minnesota, Montana, and Oklahoma.
Have any of those interpreted there?
They have not, Your Honor. The Ohio statute is the one with the crashworthiness exception, and the Maryland statute is the one with the safety belt defect exception. Additionally, if the court examines the legislative history, and we submit that that would only happen if the court were unconvinced by the plain meaning, one finds in the legislative history a heavy preoccupation with focusing civil responsibility on the party causing the accident rather than on the party causing the resultant injuries. And so applying that principle to this case, the focus would be placed civilly on the parties responsible for causing the accident. The drivers, the city of Dallas in this case, is sued for negligent design of the intersection. Conceivably, a vehicle manufacturer could be sued on some accident-causing defect, in preference to focusing responsibility on those that caused the injuries. We submit in the case of safety belt preclusion, that decision is all the more reasonable due to the extensive regulatory scheme of safety belts at the federal level. There are no fewer than three federal motor vehicle safety standards applicable to occupant restraint systems.
As far as the state legislative history, is there any
indication that the sponsors of this legislation intended to bar actions for crashworthiness against seatbelt manufacturers?
Not specifically, Your Honor. There is, however, evidence that Senator Lyon was focused on causation of accidents. And in response to arguments from defense organizations that just as a manufacturer has an obligation to make its vehicle crashworthy, so a plaintiff ought to have an obligation to make his body crashworthy, the response came back, but the safety belt use or non-use has nothing to do with causing the accident, and that's what's important. But to answer your question, there was no specific focus on crashworthiness claims as such.
You feel, nevertheless, that there's a kind of implied preemption here by the legislature of any common law cause of action?
I don't think there's anything implied about it, Your Honor. The statute is very clear and very emphatic that the use or non-use shall not be admissible in a civil trial. And as I've indicated, if there were a limitation to that, it could easily have been expressed and was easily expressed in the statutes of many other states.
Were these statutes in other states, did they tend to predate the Texas statute or post-date?
They all came around the same period of time due to the implementation of a federal regulation requiring mandatory seatbelt statutes as an alternative to an airbag requirement, such as you heard about in the previous case. Some of them date from way back. Some of them are very recent. Texas, I would say, was in the middle.
A seatbelt then fails to meet the federal standard, cannot, under your view of the law, be actionable in Texas.
That is correct, Your Honor. The remedies would be those provided by the National Transportation Safety Act.
Which are
recall, which are civil enforcement mechanisms by the U.S. Attorney General, and so forth.
So someone's killed as a result of a seatbelt in Texas that does not meet the federal minimum standard, their remedy is recall.
Their remedy is an action against the party that caused the accident, which is where the legislature placed the focus.
But
that's
a
civil remedy.
They have no civil remedy against the manufacturer of the seatbelt.
That's what we believe the statute
is. Which other states take that view?
No other states have so construed their statutes because, as I've indicated, only three states have statutes of that sweeping breadth, and they have not addressed the issue.
Is it fair to say there's no evidence that the legislature considered the impact of this statute on crashworthiness cases?
Again, yes and no, not specifically. They did, however, indicate in general terms that the focus should be on accident prevention rather than on injury prevention. And to that extent, that has implications for the crashworthiness cause of action. But they did not specifically address crashworthiness. Turning perhaps now to the constitutional issue, which I believe will relate in part to the statutory construction issue, the question before the court is whether the cause of action for a defective safety belt was a well-recognized common law cause of action in 1985. That cause of action for crashworthiness was first recognized by the Eighth Circuit in 1968 in Larson versus General Motors, first recognized by a Texas appellate court in 1974, and first recognized by this court in 1979 in Turner versus General Motors. It is clear from the pronouncements of this court and the courts of appeals that there is a temporal aspect to the test of a well-recognized common law cause of action. And indeed, such a temporal aspect is necessary and appropriate as part of this court's constitutional jurisprudence. This court and the legislature play complementary roles in refining the common law in response to the needs and conditions of a changing society. This court acts to refine the common law when an opportunity is presented in the course of a pending case. The legislature acts to refine the common law when the opportunity has not been presented to this court. And the legislature also acts in its role as the primary policymaking body in this state when it believes that this court's refinements of the common law are inappropriate or themselves in need of refinement. Now, the legislature has much more to deal with than refining the common law, and so it may or may not be able to respond to a decision of this court within the next few legislative terms. Additionally, circumstances may counsel a wait-and-see attitude with respect to a new judicially created cause of action. Thus, it may not be possible, and it may not be wise, to require the legislature to act too rapidly in act following a judicial recognition of a common law cause of action. What then is the temporal meaning of well recognized? 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? The only way to draw a bright line would be to say that a well-recognized common law cause of action is one in existence in 1876 when the Constitution was adopted.
That, so under this theory, the legislature could abolish the entire doctrine of products liability
in all manifestations. If it chose to do so.
Because it's only 30 years old.
That,
even though there are thousands of suits brought in this state.
Under that interpretation, that would be correct. I don't think that the legislature would, as a policy matter, choose to do that. But the question of whether it would have the power to do that would, under that interpretation, be resolved in favor of its having such power.
And the right to privacy, having arisen out of an 1890 law review article, the statute, the common law.
The common law right to privacy, that would be true. Not, of course, not the constitutional right to privacy. Our case does not depend on whether the court does or does not adopt that view of the open courts provision, but we did want to identify it for the court as representing an appropriate bright line test should the court choose to adopt such a test. In any event, we do not believe that 6 years, which is the time period that elapsed between Turner in 1979 and this statute in 1985, is a sufficient period of time to constitute a cause of action well recognized. That would require the legislature to act more rapidly than it may be capable of acting. It would also require the legislature to act more rapidly than may be appropriate for it to act. Independently of whether crashworthiness was a well-recognized common law cause of action in 1985, is the question of whether the statute is in any event constitutional because it represents a reasonable balance between the restriction it imposes and the purpose and basis of the statute. The respondents argue that the purpose of the statute was to save lives and that precluding a defective safety belt claim is inconsistent with that purpose. We believe that's an oversimplification of the issue. It overlooks the fact that when one party is made civilly responsible, it tends to diminish the civil responsibility of other parties. That when the focus is placed on those that cause injuries, focus is necessarily shifted away from those that cause accidents. In case of safety belt evidence, the legislature clearly did not want the focus of liability shifted away from accident-causing conduct and onto injury-causing conduct. That's clearly reflected in the legislative history. It is the purpose and basis of the pre-statute common law seatbelt rule, and it is the only rational ground for precluding safety belt use or non-use evidence, which is often the most directly probative evidence on causation of the plaintiff's injuries. The legislature's decision, as I have mentioned, is made all the more reasonable by the fact that seat belts are regulated at the federal level, and the legislature could reasonably have decided to promote prevention of safety belt defects through the existing federal law. To promote safety belt usage and thereby injury prevention through this new criminal law, mandatory seat belt usage, and to promote accident prevention by preserving the common law focus on accident preventing conduct. Now, the court may agree or it may disagree with that approach, but the question is not whether the legislature made the right decision. The question is whether the legislature made a reasonable and non-arbitrary decision. We submit that it did. We submit that the statute is therefore constitutional. And for these reasons, we urge the court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Berger will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court and the Honorable Chief Justice, my name is Barry Berger. I'm from Houston. I represent the respondents here, the plaintiffs below, who are alleging that they wore the seatbelt that they can't use in evidence because of this statute to say that it was defective. Addressing the court's first issue by Mr. Justice Phillips regarding the statutory intent here. I believe that the statutory intent here, even though it appears to say what it says, is not what the legislature meant in this case. Using the Code Construction Act, Section 3311023, which says in construing a statute, whether or not the statute is considered ambiguous on its face, the court may consider any other, among other matters, objects sought to be attained, circumstances on which the statute was enacted, legislative history, a common law, a former statutory law, and consequences of particular construction, among other things of interpretation. The legislative history in this case appears to be blank on the course of whether or not this part of the statute was considered in a crashworthiness sense. The only legislative history regarding this particular portion of the statute, 6701D, in this case, would be Senator Lyon's comments that it wouldn't be fair to require that the person wear a seatbelt and be considered contributory negligent if they didn't wear the seatbelt.
Do you agree, if we just take the statute on its face, that it would preclude the evidence in this case?
Your Honor, I think it's absurd the way it is in this as applicable to this case. I don't agree it does. It can be interpreted that way.
But if you read the statute on its face, is that what it says, or apart?
That seems to what it says, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
Under your view, what the statute ought to say, then a defendant in a car wreck case could sue the manufacturer. The defendant would be entitled to discover from the plaintiff whether the plaintiff was wearing a seatbelt or not wearing a seatbelt, because the defendant would be entitled to join the seatbelt manufacturer if it was determined the seatbelt was worn, but it failed during the accident. Then
yes,
the defendant could do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then under your, where would we draw the line then to say, well, the defendant could discover from the plaintiff whether the plaintiff was wearing a seatbelt at the time of the accident for the purposes of maybe joining the manufacturer if it failed to allocate liability for the damages, but not destroy the essence of the statute, which is to keep the defendant from using that information against the plaintiff to reallocate the damages, because now the plaintiff is going to be responsible for a certain portion of their damages by failing to have worn a seatbelt. How do we go with you without, in effect, gutting the very essence of the statute, which is we're going to keep the issue of seatbelt use out of these car wreck cases?
Well, the issue of seatbelt use only goes to whether the cause of the accident versus the enhancement of injury. These cases are enhancement of injury cases. They're considered crashworthiness, but they're also considered enhancement. Crashworthiness is a broader view of the seatbelt issue, because in a crashworthiness situation, you consider the vehicle as a whole, which is considered also part of the seatbelt. I think all that the legislative history has done in this case, and Representative Messer, and who sponsored the bill in the House of Representatives, said all we intend to do is keep the status quo. In this case, and the status quo at the time was Carnation versus Long and Duncan versus Cessna and Turner versus General Motors, which allowed the enhancement. Turner allowed the enhancement of injury cause of action. Duncan versus Cessna allocated Long or responsibility in products liability cases, and Carnation versus Long just prevented the use of a seatbelt to show that the person, or non-use of the seatbelt, shows the person was contributory negligent or not.
Are there any seatbelt product cases like this one in Texas jurisprudence?
Yes, Your Honor, there are plenty of cases. This is the first time that I'm aware of that this issue of using the statute, a penal statute, a statute designed entitled requiring people to wear a seatbelt for their own safety has been raised, which would be used to preclude the evidence that a person was wearing a seatbelt and was hurt, or their injuries were enhanced because the seatbelt was either defectively designed, manufactured, or altered by the dealer in this case, or some other type of problems with the seatbelt itself. This would even go to the airbag type of situation, which has not been raised in this case yet. This is, as far as I'm aware, in Texas, this is it. There's two cases that we cite in our brief that have been decided subsequent to the passage of the Act, which really does not answer the issue of the applicability of the statute. So this is a case of first impression in this state. And as I think, it's a case of first impression in most states, even in the states decided by the petitioners, which have a fairly broad statute than most of the other states, Montana, Oklahoma, which I think I disagree with, and Minnesota, all those states recognize the enhancement injury theory, the crashworthiness theory, and have not applied the statute in those states.
You have cases from Montana and Minnesota?
They're in part of the brief, part of our respondents reply to the petition's writ of error now. Lists a list of cases that recognize the enhancement theory, which includes Montana, Oklahoma, and Minnesota. We believe in this situation that the statute, even though it seems to say what it says, can be at the court without getting to the constitutional issue in this case of the open court provision, even though that's what the lower court went off on. It didn't go off on the statutory construction, which was raised in the lower court. This part of the statute can be viewed as being ambiguous because it's internally inconsistent with the rest of the statute, which was designed to require people to wear seatbelts because the purpose of the statute was wearing safety belts required is to save lives. And here, in this situation, we have what, in a sense, is an absurd result. We have a situation where we allege that a person was wearing a seatbelt, and we have physical evidence to show the fact that the person had seatbelt trauma in this accident. Mrs. Glenn Jones had seatbelt trauma according to the medical records. But a person who was wearing a seatbelt, which didn't prevent her from being thrown around the car, she can't use that evidence in a trial to find liability on behalf of the seatbelt manufacturer, which is Firestone in this case, and some of the other defendants in the case, like Ford.
You're not asking for a straight-up affirmance of the Court of Appeals decision based on its determination?
Well, we'd like to see it, Your Honor. We believe the Court of Appeals erred in also in not considering that the statute was ambiguous, and that was not the purpose of the statute.
Are you making alternative arguments, or are you...
I've made alternative arguments in the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, and not to reach the constitutional issue.
If we did have to reach the constitutional issue, can you give us some guidance on what well-established means?
Your Honor, I think this well-established means, or it's other cases have cited, cognizable or well-recognized, words defining what it is. I think it's something that's been around for some time. I don't think we have to go back to use, as petitioners say, the bright line test of going back to the Constitution of 1876 to determine what a well-established common law principle is. However, even if you did, I would say that the case of Mom versus Marin, and Director of Department of Agriculture versus Printing Industries, which says that if you're going to look at in the open courts packet provision or what the Constitution meant back in 1876, you have to be interpreted in light of conditions existing at that time, and the general spirit and prevailing sentiment. Of course, 1876 was right after Reconstruction, and the purpose of the Article 1, Section 13 was to assure the people that a political body, a legislative political body, wouldn't arbitrarily take away causes of action that were recognized by common law. Of course, products liability cases were not in existence at that time, but common law did recognize strict liability, in a sense, in ultra-hazardous type of industries, and I believe animals and such as that. So there was a strict liability concept back in 1876. I don't think, though, that the court would have to go back to that to determine what a cognizable or well-recognized or well-established principle of common law is. This principle adopted in 1979 was continued in Texas up until the time the statute was enacted. It continued after that, except for this case that I'm aware of. It's continued in every other state. In the United States, it was recognized the enhancement injury theory. It's been around for a long time. To me, that is well established. A cognizable common law cause of action that's been in existence. It's been upheld by the Supreme Court a number of times and been mentioned in various other cases by various other appellate courts.
If we reach a constitutional basis, you would argue that it's unconstitutional as applied to a crashworthiness case rather than argue that it's facially unconstitutional?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it can be ardent under the Code Construction Act 311.032. I think it can be argued and construed that it's on its as applied to crashworthiness cases in this type of situation, both from the plaintiff's standpoint is arguing that they were wearing a seatbelt, and from the defense standpoint if they want to show that they were not wearing a seatbelt, that enhanced the injury because of that situation. In a crashworthiness type case, such as this case, then the statute as applied to these type of fact situations would be unconstitutional. I think the provision itself says that Section C of 311.032 says the invalidity of one section does not affect other provisions or application of the statute that can be have an effect without the provision or that particular application not part of the statute.
If it's unconstitutional in crashworthiness cases, why isn't it unconstitutional in all cases?
I think using this part of the statute, or construction of the statute, it can be given validity in other cases where it was intended to give validity in use where a person is alleging that a person was negligent because they were wearing a seatbelt or not wearing a seatbelt, or somebody saying that I was not negligent because I was wearing a seatbelt.
If someone was not wearing a seatbelt and was negligent for not doing that, and that was the principal cause of their injuries, why shouldn't you be able to show that in the case? If the statute is unconstitutional and crashworthy.
I think the purpose of the statute, Your Honor, at least expressed in the legislative history in that case, was that it was designed to keep common law in place, the status quo. The status quo at the time was that you cannot use a seatbelt to show that a person was contributory negligence in the cause of the accident. If it's a crashworthiness case, then it goes to enhancement of injury. And that's the only issue in a crashworthiness case, is the enhancement of the injury, so increasing in injury because of defective design or manufacture of the automobile, including the seatbelt, rather than the cause of the accident itself.
You have the same enhancement problem in just an ordinary accident.
Well, you have that all the time, but again, here the legislative history in this case was to keep the status quo. The status quo was that even if it enhanced the injury because the person did not wear a seatbelt, that is a different type of case where it involved a causation issue. And I think Duncan versus sets out the court's determination of how to allocate losses regarding where you have common law causes of action for negligence in the case of an intersection collision between the two vehicles versus a product liability case. And that's how the issue would be resolved, and the court has addressed that issue in Duncan versus Sussman. And it seems it's done so in Poole versus Ford Motor Company, establishing that. In fact, Poole versus Ford Motor Company says, again, that even though they recognize that the statute was passed and the statute didn't apply to that particular accident or situation because the accident happened before the statute was passed, that the purpose of the statute was to keep the status quo. And again, the status quo was there was crashworthiness cases were recognized. You could use evidence or non-evidence of seat belts to show enhancement of injury, but you cannot use a person that not wearing a seat belt was the cause of the accident, contributory negligence caused the accident. We believe that the court, looking at the statute, looking at the object sought to be attained, that is the basic portion of the statute was to save lives, requiring people to wear seat belts, forcing them to do so under the penalty of being fined for not doing so, is not served by not allowing a person who is wearing a seatbelt to not be able to bring evidence of the fact that she was wearing a seatbelt in a cause of action against the manufacturer of the seatbelt, such as Firestone, or against the designer of the seatbelt, such as Ford, or against the dealer, who was also a defendant in this case, for altering or tampering with the seatbelt.
How is it served, though, by allowing a person who was not using the seatbelt to recover damages anyway?
And not wearing a seatbelt cover damages in an enhancement case?
In just a regular case.
I think what the legislators intended, Your Honor, was to keep the status quo again. That's what the common law was. And where there's a cause, where it's the issue is causing the accident. Where it's an enhancement case, it is a different issue altogether, and the legislature didn't even consider it now.
But your argument, as I understood it, was that the policy is to try to promote wearing seatbelts. And how is that policy promoted if you allow persons who are not wearing seatbelts to recover anyway?
It's promoted by they get a ticket, Your Honor. They're fined for doing it. That's what the purpose of the statute was.
You get a ticket, and then you recover damages from the defendant.
You recover damages from the defendant if it caused the action for something besides not wearing a seatbelt. It's the policy was determined was to maintain and keep the status quo as the common law, and that was the common law. And I think that is mentioned in the legislative history. Again, you can look at the existing common law in this case, and the existing common law was allowing evidence of the use of a seatbelt in an enhancement type case where the allegations were that the person, the seatbelt was defective design and manufacture. The consequences of the particular construction would give an absurd result in this case, and I can't emphasize that more, but it's just absurd to believe that the legislature intended this type of thing, and if it did intend it, it's arbitrary and unreasonable under the open court's provisions. It deprived this person completely of the remedy against Firestone in this particular case. In other words, it could never sue Firestone.
Berger, now that the state recognizes allocation of damages as opposed to contributory negligence, would there be any purpose to this statute in existence today?
Uh, Your Honor, I think there would be, yes. It would be in a strictly one-on-one mainstream car accident case.
But if you no longer recognize contributory negligence, but simply an allocation of damages based on negligence, then would there be any purpose for the statute now? Wouldn't each person have to now be responsible for their conduct that contributes to it?
I think under the way the case is applied, no, Your Honor, that would not have been the common law. In fact, Carnation versus Wong had comparative negligence in it, or allocation of damages at that time. And Duncan versus Cessna, there was also that. So I think the legislature intended to keep that situation.
This statute could not be constitutionally applied, according to your argument, in a circumstance where negligence allegations and product liability allegations based on a crashworthiness theory were joined. Is that correct?
I think it could be. I think it could allocate the damages on the Duncan versus Cessna. In this situation, the issues as to the causes of the action, whether a person is negligent in the cause of the action, is different from whether the person is negligent or was not wearing a seatbelt in the enhancement, because they would be able to show that they were not wearing a seatbelt for enhancement purposes to show that there was no proximate cause or producing cause of the design of the seatbelt or manufacture of the seatbelt which caused the accident. You see, or the cause of the injury. So causation of the injuries was paramount. I think the courts could allocate and determine causation of the accident versus causation of the injury.
Any other questions?
I believe my time is up, Your Honor. You can. Appreciate it.
May it please the court. I think standing here in 1994, we all suffer from a little bit of lack of perspective. Crashworthiness has now been around in this state for 15 years, and we've come to accept it as a well-known part of the common law. But I think we need to cast ourselves back to 1985 when this statute was enacted. Approximately 6 or 7 years earlier, someone like myself had stood at this podium and argued to this court in Turner versus General Motors that crashworthiness should not be recognized in Texas. This court rejected those arguments and adopted the crashworthiness doctrine, but the question is, would it have been absurd for it to have done otherwise? Were those arguments absurd, and were the courts in prior years, such as the Seventh Circuit in the Evans case, absurd in declining to recognize that doctrine? Were the courts in which Section 402A was adopted, but in which crashworthiness was rejected, absurd in doing so? I phrase the question that way because that is the test. This court held in the Marino case and in many other cases that where the language of suit is unambiguous, the intent of the legislature must be found in the terms used in the statute. It held a few months ago in CNH Nationwide that rule must give way when the statute as literally read and applied would reach an absurd result. And so the question this court must address on the statutory construction side is crashworthiness so obvious and so important that a failure to recognize it or a legislative abolition of it in part 6 years after its adoption would be absurd? We submit that it would not. We submit that a focus on accident prevention to the exclusion of injury prevention may or may not be the best approach, but it is not an absurd approach. Mr. Justice Heck asked whether the purpose of the statute would not be served by the evidentiary preclusion section in a non-crashworthiness case. And at first blush, it would not, because admitting evidence of non-use for purposes of comparative responsibility would indeed have the effect of promoting seatbelt use. But clearly, the legislature did intend to preclude use for that purpose. And so I think we have to look more broadly at what the purpose of the preclusion section may have been. and I think you can find a rational purpose for that section in the focus of civil responsibility on accident prevention. Now, the legislature was not dealing with a statute dealing with vehicles generally, and so we don't know how it would come out on the question of whether the crashworthiness doctrine should be abolished in toto. But we do know, in the specific context of safety belts, which are specifically regulated at the federal level, that the legislature passed the statute which it passed in the face of many other statutes from around the country which were much more narrowly drawn. We believe that the broad language of the statute must be applied as it is written, that that does not reach an absurd result, that the court therefore must reach and address the open courts question, and that both because crashworthiness was not in 1985 a well-recognized common law cause of action, because the societal quid pro quo of focusing on accident prevention outweighs the restriction of the statute, and because of an issue addressed in our application but not here today, that is the existence of alternative remedies against the vehicle manufacturer, the other driver, the city of Dallas, and so forth, that the court must hold that the application of the open courts provision is constitutional in this case.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Governor.
That concludes the arguments and the second clause, and the court will take another brief recess.
The audience will be brought.